Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. If there's one thing that Bostonians love to do more than telling everyone how much they love their city, it's telling everyone what they hate about it.
The weather, the tea, the traffic, the cost, the schools, the pollution, Did I mention that? No, but seriously, the fact is Boston is the hub of New England, if not the universe.
And the fact is Boston's importance to the region mirrors the importance of urban areas nationwide. More than two-thirds of Americans live on the 3% of land that contains the nation's cities.
And even though in the 70s and the 80s, American cities got a very bad rep, including Boston, there's one Harvard economist who believes that cities are the best, most important engines of American prosperity.
And his name is Edward Glaser. He's got a new book out called Triumph of the City.
And there's always a subtitle with these things. His happens to be How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, Happier, Even in Boston. I actually just added the last part, but really, Glaser has become one of the most unusual and vocal champions of urban life. So I recently hopped on the Green Line to meet up with him not far from Government Center. And a tour guide in a tri-cornered hat, when we got there, reminded us that the idea of Boston as an urban hotbed goes way back.
Fire one at a time. There's nine men, they fire nine shots, and then they start firing the second round. Five men are dead, nine other people are hit, and they call that the Boston Massacre. And this occurred right here.
Ed Glaser, thank you so much for meeting us here in front of the Old State House.
Thank you so much for talking to me here.
The reason why we wanted to start our little tour in front of the Old State House is it's one of the more ironic things that you point out in your book, that this, of course, is the site of the famed Boston Massacre, a riot, essentially. But you say that the riot and the positive things that came from it couldn't have happened if Boston wasn't already a vibrant city center, even in the colonial era. Why is that?
I think that's right. I think it's important to recognize that the ideas that came together to create the American Revolution were ideas that were made possible by having such a wide range of smart, intelligent, active people in the city. So you've got on one hand John Hancock, a man who badly wanted a change in British policies. After all, his wealth depended upon it. And he needed a way to make that happen. He needed a mob. He needed an uprising. And Boston connected him to Sam Adams, a man who, like many purveyors of alcoholic beverages, knew how to conjure a mob. And the two of them were actually able to make history and actually create this remarkable change. The massacre itself is an utterly remarkable point in world history, right? It's a point in which the British Army comes into conflict with the citizens of Boston, unhappy about a soldier allegedly not paying his bills, hurling stuff at him. A great visible incident occurs, an incident that becomes a rallying cry for the citizens of Boston. All of these things, the ideas about change, the ideas about alleged British transgressions, they spread throughout the dense confines of Boston. And they're used to be the starting point for this great country. And I think that's one of the central points of the book, is that cities are no less American than any other part of America. And that America's history is very much made by its cities like Boston. And I think this site helps to make that point.
It makes sense that in the 18th century, with Sam Adams and John Hancock all living in close proximity with each other and rubbing elbows, that you'd have that exchange of ideas. And that's one of the reasons why cities were so important then. But now, with people being interconnected digitally, is it really important for folks to be living so close to each other in dense areas like this one in Boston?
Well, that's the amazing thing about globalization and new technologies, is they seem to be making cities more, not less important. And I think the fundamental thing here is that we are, at our heart, a social species. Sure, we can communicate low-intensity ideas effortlessly over the web, but to really communicate, to get the most complicated notions across, you actually have to connect with your audience. You actually need to see what they're seeing, get a sense of what they know as part of communicating really hard ideas. Cities also, of course, transmit ideas through completely happenstance occurrences. Young people who come to work are going to learn things from the people around them, not through planned meetings, which perhaps could be done electronically in some ways, but by just seeing the smarter people around them who are doing things successfully, or the dumber people who are screwing up. After all, we learn as much from the mistakes that we observe from the successes.
So, Ed Glaser, as much as I love history, let's head towards the waterfront where and the location where Mayor Menino's calling Boston's new innovation district.
Let's do it. One of the things I think that's so wonderful about Boston and the fact that it has allowed itself to rebuild is the fact that we see buildings from different centuries having, in some sense, a dialogue with one another. Look here, look at sort of the old State House and all of its Federalist era glory, connecting there with the brutalist facade of City Hall, despised by many,
Center.
But still of interest in architecture, to the modern tower over there, to the neoclassical facade over there. It's a wonderful combination of different architectural visions coming together, much as cities bring, you know, strange and wonderful people together. The city of centuries, like Boston, also brings different architectural styles together, and that's a treat as well.
So, Ed Glaser, I mean, that makes Boston a really pretty place to walk around because it's interesting to look at. But how does that translate into its strength as a city, as an engine for growth and a place to live?
Well, I often say that the right long-run development strategy is to attract and train smart people and then get out of their way. But attracting smart people is not easy. And one of the ways we do it is by having a beautiful city, is by allowing the city's natural amenities to flourish. But it also helps the city because these new buildings, these taller buildings, provide Boston with the space it badly needs to grow. As much as it's, you know, wonderful to revel in the beautiful shorter buildings of the past, if you have a city like Boston that's successful, that has managed to reinvent itself after the 1970s when deindustrialization looked like it was tossing Boston into the trash heap of history, that manages through smart people and successful policies to reinvent itself. And the city succeeds also as a place of pleasure as well as productivity. Boston has plenty of demand for it, and that translates into rising prices unless there's more supply.
Well, I was actually just going to ask you that because not far from where we are and in the direction that we'll be heading, there's still that tension in terms of getting the right balance of density and livability. Obviously, one of the big battles going on near the harbor is with Don Chiafaro wants to build a really tall set of towers so that more people can live there, and the city of Boston is not letting that happen.
Well, the mayor is certainly correct not to give rights away for nothing. And this is a complicated dance. There's not an obvious right answer here. But I certainly believe on a general level that Boston needs to grow up. And we need to understand that while it's nice to keep sunlight and views, there's always a cost to that as well. And the cost is that Boston becomes more expensive, more exclusive, and in some sense, less vibrant.
Shall we keep going?
Wonderful.
Well, listeners, Ed Glaser is walking with me at the moment, but he's also going to join us live in a few minutes to take your calls and questions. So what do you make of what he's said so far? What does the hub do well, and what doesn't it do well? I mean, Boston's one of America's great cities, but can it stay that way? Especially when our competition may not be just New York, but places like Shanghai, London, or Sao Paulo. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or comment on the web at radioboston.org. So, Ed Glaser, we've arrived at the Greenway. We're right on Atlantic Avenue, just within sight of the harbor, right next to the aquarium. It's one of the great spots where, in very recent history, Boston has completely reinvented itself, or at least this part of it, because, of course, at one time, we would have been standing in the middle of an 8-lane highway, which is currently underneath us.
Absolutely, and now this is a wonderful space that really enables you to enjoy the light, enjoy the city, and, you know, see in some sense the whole course of Boston, both present and future, in front of you. Right over there, of course, you see the wharves, right? The remnant of Boston's historic harbor. And it's easy now to forget, particularly if you're any parts further west, how much early Boston depended upon the sea. Moving goods across land in this country in the early days was incredibly difficult, right? At the start of the 19th century, it cost as much to move goods 32 miles over land as it did to have them cross the Atlantic. And as a result, the Atlantic seaboard was a lifeline for the colonists living here. And we all sat here perched on the eastern seaboard connected by those waterways. That, of course, meant that Boston was playing a critical role connecting America with the rest of the world, and it made, of course, Boston a very international city, a very internationally connected connected city. One of the things that actually makes Boston important today is its global connections, the fact that it's a very comfortable city for people from different countries to come to. It's a city that many people describe as having a very European flair, which is odd, of course, given that it's one of the oldest American cities and in some sense one of the most American of cities. But it certainly is comfortable for non-Americans to live in. And given that America is becoming and will become an ever smaller share of the world economy, and that's not bad, right? That's a sign of the rest of the world getting rich, and that's something that we should admire. But the fact that Boston is one of the cities that serves as a conduit to the outside world will only make the city stronger over time.
But Ed Glaser, let me ask you, those global connections in many ways are being made, as you said, first of all, through immigrants coming in, mm-hmm. but also through a class of jobs that requires a lot of higher education. I mean, Boston absolutely is a hub for innovation, biotech, digital technologies, all those sorts of things. But the kind of jobs that you were referring to that were once available at the harbor, for example, just aren't there so much anymore. I mean, the harbor itself is active, but it's nowhere near as active as it was in the 19th century. So there's an entire group of Bostonians, a group of people. Where's their source of economic dynamism if it's no longer in good sort of middle-class jobs of the sort that we once had, say, at the harbor?
I actually think Boston does a reasonably good job relative to many parts of the country of providing opportunities for those people that have less formal education. And I think it illustrates the way that cities actually create opportunities by connecting, people who have capital and skills with people who have less. One of the stories that I tell in the book is a very well-known story in American history, but of course it's the story of the Kennedys coming to Boston.
Yes.
And it's a story of, destitute, poor Irish immigrants coming to the city with very little, but he gets a job as a cooper. He gets a job making barrels, right? That's great. Somebody with, capital manages to employ somebody without capital, and something good happens. And then, of course, this whole chain of the city making this great American dynasty happens, which, shows this ability of cities to be engines of opportunity. I think that also illustrates one of the big points that I have in the book, which is that the fact that there are poor people living in Boston is not something that Boston should ever be ashamed of. The fact that there is urban poverty is not something that cities should be ashamed of, because cities don't make people poor. Cities attract poor people. They attract poor people because they deliver things that poor people need most of all, economic opportunity, which, despite the problems that we have, is more available in our cities than in areas in which there aren't people for poor people to partner with to enhance their productivity, but also because you can get around without a car for every adult.
Do you think that Boston still has the similar rungs to the ladder that allowed the Kennedys to rise? Do we still have that today?
I think it's harder, but there is still plenty of economic opportunity in the city, and Boston enables people with less to find that opportunity. I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna. I'm not suggesting that there aren't major issues and that in some sense things aren't harder with the elimination of jobs that could just rely on manual labor. That is a challenge, and it's a challenge this country needs to face. And it's a challenge that actually calls for investments in education, right? It calls for the human capital investments that are so important. But I think that cities are far more likely to be the solution for this than for the problem, precisely because they connect people.
Should we walk just a little bit down the Greenway
here?
And actually, speaking of the Greenway, I suppose there's much good to be said about it, but a common complaint is that it's not very green. But it is a place in which Boston has tried to bring the natural environment back into the city. And you say that that's one of the things that's good about neighborhoods like this.
Sure. Certainly plenty of people, including myself, like trees, and it's a nice thing to see some green in the city. It's a nice thing to have well-designed urban parks. Boston obviously has this, tremendous jewel of the Emerald Necklace that Olmsted designed. But as we think about cities in nature, it's important to remember the largest environmental contribution that cities make. And I'd like to illustrate this by just telling a story about a young Harvard graduate and a friend who went for a picnic in the woods outside of Concord in a spring day of 1844. They went and they did a little bit of fishing, and the fishing was quite good because there hadn't been much rain lately. And they took their fish and they cooked it up in a chowder. And as they were cooking, the wind flicked the flames to the nearby grass. And since the grass was dry, the fire spread. And soon there was an inferno that burned down more than 300 acres of prime Concord woodland. This young man, during his Day was castigated as an enemy of the local woodlands, as an enemy of the environment. The Concord Freeman called him a flibberty gibbet, which I gather was truly damning in 1844. But today, of course, that young man is the secular saint of American environmentalism, Henry David Thoreau, who, as far as I can tell, did more damage to the environment than anyone I know living at the same point in time
now,
in downtown Boston.
I read that part in your book, and I'm not sure if that's terribly fair. I mean, you're really comparing one little fire to the kind of pollution and resource use that shopkeepers might actually generate?
One little fire of more than 300 acres of Concord woodland? He burned down the whole...
But on the other hand, his celebration of Walden Woods, for example, is what led to... You could say that's what led to its preservation.
Perhaps, but it may have also led more Americans to live surrounded by woodlands, and that's not particularly good for the environment either. So I think it's hard to actually...
Not good for the environment. Why?
Well, because the carbon emissions associated with dense living is just substantially lower than the carbon emissions associated with low-density
living. Smaller houses and people not driving.
Smaller housings and people not driving. So it's both public transportation, but also even for people who do drive around a town like Brookline, they're just driving much shorter distances than people who live around Walden Pond. And the second factor is even controlling... I mean, look, they're cars, but they're not moving
pollution very
far. And the other big difference, of course, is smaller houses, right? That holding income and family size constant, if you're living in an urban apartment, you're just using, on average, much less electricity and much less home heating than if you're living in a large suburban house. And these are both things that make cities look pretty green despite the absence of obvious greenery.
And Glazer, let's take a step back here. You've laid out a ton of great reasons why Boston is not just a wonderful city, but a real engine for growth and prosperity, and quite frankly, its own future and the future of the country. But on the other hand, every time the census is run, Mayor Menino standing there saying, no, we are not losing people, no matter what the numbers say. So I guess my point is that the macro level issues which you raise speak to Boston's strength. But when it comes to where people actually decide to live, there's a bunch of other micro-level issues that may trump all the reasons why you think people should be in the city.
Well, there are a couple of big issues that are related to Boston's lack of population growth, one of which we can't do anything about. There's no avoiding the fact that Americans during the 20th century have moved wildly to sunnier areas. There's no variable that better predicts metropolitan area growth than January temperature, and that's certainly something Boston needs to live with. The other thing, though, that is really important, the growth of an area is intimately tied to the growth in its housing stock. This isn't just demand side. This is also about supply. And Boston has, and I don't mean the city, I mean the region. The region has one of the most restrictive land use environments in the eastern U.S., that we make it extraordinarily difficult to build new housing. And if you don't build homes, you're not going to add more people. But we've enacted a web of regulations that have made it extraordinarily difficult to build at the local level. And again, I want to make it clear that suburbs are far more guilty of this, if you will, than the central city. But if we don't actually push back on that, the region is going to continue to get expensive and not going to see growth. And unfortunately, too many people find that their children can't afford to live in the neighborhoods that they grew up in because we're not supplying the homes that people want.
And finally, Ed Glazer, I'm just going to have to say, I think it's time for you to come clean. You are the celebrant of the city, and yet, as far as I understand, you don't even live in Boston.
I don't even live in Boston.
That's absolutely right.
Once I started acquiring small children, you can tell I'm an economist. Only economists talk about acquiring children. About 5 years ago, my wife and I did what millions of Americans do throughout the country, and we chose a suburb. We watched our carbon footprint soar as a result. And I discuss my choice in the book because I think it illustrates certain major issues in terms of public policy. It illustrates the way that our public policy stacks the deck against our cities. So if you think about my move and the move of millions of Americans, we were abetted by the home mortgage interest deduction, which essentially bribes Americans to move out of urban apartments into suburban homes. We were facilitated by the Massachusetts Turnpike, which itself was not subsidized by the federal government, but many other highways were. And of course, our system of local schooling, which pushes so many parents to move out of cities into lower density areas, also stacks the deck against cities. It's just very, very hard for cities to compete on this. And I think that's one of the reasons why thinking about reforming all of these areas is so important, and that's why I bring that up. But I also think it's worthwhile, you know, emphasizing that while it's true that I go to sleep in a suburb, my work, my productivity happens in cities. And when I, you know, when I have a free weekend day with my kids, when I can convince them to get in the car and, you know, emit a little more carbon, we come here. And certainly I know of no place that my kids love more than the aquarium that we're looking at out right here. And certainly the city is, you know, such an anchor to the region and such a place of both productivity and joy to many of us, who, even those of us who don't actually live within its borders, that, you know, thinking about why we treasure it is I think an important thing to do.
Well, Ed Glaser, thanks so much for taking a walk with us through Boston today.
Thank you so much for walking with me as well.
Well, when we come back, Ed Glaser joins Anthony live to take your calls and questions. His new book is Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. So what do you make of it? If you're living in the greater Boston area, are you richer, smarter, greener, healthier, and happier? Then whom? And if you're farther flung, do you look at the Boston grind and wonder if Ed Glaser needs a reality check? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back. Radio Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to continue our conversation now with Ed Glaser about what makes cities great, and specifically about what Boston needs to do to be an even greater city. Glaser is a Harvard economist and the author of The Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. And we've moved from the streets of Boston back into the studio so that you can join the conversation. What do you make of Ed Glaser's thesis about cities? And what would make Boston a stronger city? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Ed Glaser joins us now from the studios at NPR in Washington. Thanks for coming in again, Mr. Glaser. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So your tour with Meghna, it was great. I listened carefully, and I want to talk to you just to sort of kick off this part of the discussion about your decision to move out of the city, as you said, which was due to your acquisition of small children. I want to talk to you more about the public policy that is stacked against cities. And in that way, remind us why cities produce better restaurants than schools, which I found a sort of provocative way of putting it in your book.
Right. So cities produce great restaurants because it harnesses the powers of competition and innovation that can so easily flourish in our urban areas. There's a new eatery opening every couple of days, it seems, in Boston. Some of them are succeeding, some of them are failing. But it's that healthy process of competition that actually makes Boston a fun place to eat. The same thing is true in London, the same thing is true in New York, the same thing is true in Chicago. This system where private entrepreneurs get a new idea, we want some new kind of fusion restaurant, we want some kind of old-style eating, we want to produce the best mashed potatoes, or heck, who would have known that there would have been this market for upscale cupcakes? Mm. And yet, you know, entrepreneurs are making this happen. That shows cities at their best. Now, let's think about what would happen to food quality in Boston if we assigned all the eating within the city to a single food superintendent who would establish a system of public eateries that would dole out the food that the superintendent thought that we needed. Now, it is true that we might have fewer trans fats in our diet. That might be correct. But on the other hand, flavor would be pretty much out the window, too, or at least that would be my prediction about what would happen, because you wouldn't have any of this bubbling up from the ground level of new ideas and innovation. Now, for very good reasons, Boston pioneered public interventions in education, and that's something to celebrate in America, right? Our centuries of public schooling, which Greater Boston played such an important role in with people like Horace Mann, were critical to the country's success in the 19th and early 20th centuries. But as we go forward, we have to realize that our public schools, particularly the large ones in urban areas, are really failing those cities and are creating a strong incentive for so many people to leave urban areas and go elsewhere. I think that one thing that will help make urban cities more productive is to get more competition and innovation in the system. And I was just looking at some of the most recent results on charter schools from researchers Josh Angrist and Tom Kane. And it really is remarkable the extent to which those charter schools that are oversubscribed seem to do a terrific job of raising test scores. Now, there are two caveats to that data, one of which is that some of the charter schools are not, and they're not oversubscribed. And that's just what you'd expect. Not all new restaurants are good either, right? Mm-hmm. So, in fact, we expect the process to lead to a bunch of losers as well as winners. And the other thing which I think makes the point about cities and competition is that there aren't comparable test score gains in suburban charter schools, that really the success is really centralized in urban areas. And I think that offers the hope that breathing more competition into the school system will be helpful in terms of leveling the playing field between cities and suburbs in terms of school quality.
So one approach to that is more charter schools. Of course, that sort of raises a whole, or enlarges, I guess, a political debate around public education, which maybe we'll get into. But I want to get to some calls right away because we've got some great calls sort of stacked up here. So let's get right into them. Curtis is calling from Jamaica Plain. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, how are you? I'm glad you took my call.
Glad to take it. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a lifelong resident of Boston. I love the city. And I think one of the big, there are many issues that could affect Boston's growth and development. But I think one is the growth of the underclass. And this is a nationwide thing. We have an urban underclass, we have a rural underclass, and we're having an increasing suburban underclass. And what I mean by underclass is people who've been unemployed for long periods of time, and a culture takes place as people are outside of the mainstream. And we should look south to Mexico and see the danger of that. The elites in Mexico did not address this with education. They didn't address this with health care and job creation and just depending on the market. And what happened is they have this huge underclass, and the army has been defeated by them.
Sure. So, Curtis, let's put a question to Ed Glaser about that. And if I may, let me just jump in and sort of try. Go ahead.
I just want to say one thing.
Sure.
I want to say something about the education. It is really important that the young people in this city go through a rite of passage. And education is one rite of passage. Education based on tests. One size fits all. It may be great for the middle class, but this is not going to work for the underclass.
All right.
So, these are things that are really important if we are going to. And I'll just leave with one question, not one answer. We had a shooting.
Curtis, I'm just going to jump in because we really have so many people to get to, and I really appreciate the points you've made. And Ed Glaser, let me put sort of try to wrap up one of I think what's implied in Curtis's question, and that is, to what extent is the politics of cities polarized? In other words, the so-called urban agenda often seems to be owned by the left and has to do with how to provide more opportunities for low-income people, job training, health care reform. And these aren't usually issues that are embraced by conservatives. First of all, do you agree with that, and how do we get around that?
Well, I certainly agree with you that it does cities no good to be seen as being allied only with one party. I think cities really could use more healthy competition. And I think one of the things is that it's somewhat odd that the Republican Party, which has its ancestry in Alexander Hamilton's New York Federalists, right, doesn't embrace more urban values, which often, you know, it's where competition and innovation thrives best. I have the hope, at least, that the education agenda, which Curtis talked about, is something that can move across party lines. And I really think it is the strength of this country over the next 50 years depends upon its human capital. It depends upon making sure that every child has a decent education, and it depends upon lifting the education for all of America, and making sure that we're constantly innovating in this sector and we're leading the world in this sector. And I really think that any party that doesn't invest in this area and doesn't consider it, you know, their job to make America stronger through its human capital, I think they're going to lose out because of it. And I think that at least offers me some hope.
We're talking with Ed Glaser about what makes cities great and what can be done to make Boston a great city. And let's go to Leela, who's calling from Brookline. Hi, Leela.
Hi. I just moved to Brookline with great intention. I had a couple of eye surgeries, and I decided that I would be in prison if I remained in the burbs. And I can't begin to tell you the joy it has given me. I walk out of the door and I see the world. The benefits I get are fewer chain stores and a lot of individually owned quirky stores. I can walk and walk and walk, and I even got the benefit of an improved health exam. So giving up my car was a benefit to the world, but it's a bigger benefit to me.
All right, Lila. So what do you hear in there, Ed Glaser? There's a nice advertisement for one of the points you're making, or several of the points you're making, I would say.
Absolutely. And I think she's speaking about two things that I heard, at least, one of which is just the joys of exploring a city street, where you get to see the process of your neighbors coming up with clever ideas all the time, these quirky shops, these new things. In some sense, city streets can be a stage for seeing and experiencing all of human creativity. But there's a second point here, which I think is a big deal, which is that cities have gone from being killing fields to places of remarkable health. A child born in New York City in 1900 could expect to live 7 years less than the national average. A child born today in New York City can expect to live 2 years more than the national average. Boston is also similarly a very healthy area. Now, that change didn't happen automatically, and that change required massive investments, most of all in clean water, as work by David Cutler and Grant Miller shows. City governments were spending as much on water in the start of the 20th century as the federal government was spending on everything except for the post office and the army. Amazing investment required to actually deliver that most important of all city services, clean water. And that, along with paving the streets and other urban public health innovations, helped make the current flourishing of cities possible. And now, of course, you have this city health thing. And I think walking around is one story, which is probably important. Among younger people, urban health is really clearly associated with two primary sources of death that are just much rarer in cities. And one of which is lower levels of motor vehicle accidents. Not a big surprise. Taking the T while tipsy is just a lot safer than driving drunk, and that's an important thing for younger people. The second thing, which is slightly more puzzling, is the lower level of suicides in big cities. So I don't think we fully understand this. One hypothesis is it has to do with social connections in cities not leading to the same sense of extreme isolation that may exist in lower density areas. Another hypothesis is that it just has to do with gun availability for ordinary people. And certainly some work that I've done, actually again with David Cutler, shows a strong correlation between hunting licenses, and of course hunting is the strongest correlate of owning a gun in your household across America, but there's a strong correlation between hunting licenses and suicide rates across counties in this country for young people.
Well, of course, this whole idea of the dystopia, the sort of dystopic vision of the suburbs is an old theme even in sort of mid-20th century literature. So this is an idea that's been out there, isn't it? That moving out of the suburbs, it represents the sort of fulfillment of part of the American dream, but it doesn't always work out that way.
You know, I think in some sense the theme of the book is that cities are just as American as any other part. Mm-hmm. Cities offer great things, but different people like different things. And I'm not arguing that everyone should live in a city. I'm just arguing that cities do in fact have great benefits for many people, like our last caller, who seems to be flourishing.
Sure. Well, here's on our website, Rebecca writes that she, along with Jim, acquired a small child like you, Ed Glaser. She says, "We moved 2 years ago from the city, but regret that decision. We now want to move back. Any suggestions on what we need to do to prepare for that move?"
Oh boy, I'm not really a lifestyle coach.
Well, let me ask you. I could put it this way and make it easier for you. Is this a decision that you've thought about revisiting?
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Oh sure. Certainly, I've thought about revisiting it. And there are. I am. You know, I often think, as much as it opens me to charges of hypocrisy to live in a suburb and to write this book, I've often thought that in fact it's highly beneficial for my own perspective to have experienced both suburban and urban living. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. I think actually, and it would be very hard for someone who rented and had only lived in a city to actually be at all convincing on making a case against the home mortgage interest deduction. Oh. Right. It would seem purely. But you know, I'm a homeowner. I've got a mortgage. I'm making a case case that clearly isn't in my financial self-interest. So I think it's useful to have both experiences, and for many people, suburbs work well. But it's very easy to think about the pleasures that you have from just being able to walk, you know, with your kid to a local playground, and to have actually the life of the city right around you. And certainly, some of my favorite moments with my kids have been in Boston playgrounds, have been in the Common, and just in places where they've mixed with the wonderful mass of humanity that's there.
Well, let's take another call. Lawrence is calling from West Roxbury. Hi, Lawrence.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I must apologize for not having read Mr. Glazer's book yet, but there are two points I want to make. One is that Boston is usually not just considered Boston. You know, Boston here is a regional metropolitan area that goes as far north as Haverhill, south to Plymouth, and west to Worcester. And one of the losses that has taken place over the past 30 years, and if you're going to talk about cities, and Boston being one of them, is the loss of its manufacturing jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge amount of wealth that those workers represented. And that had such an impact on all of the things that the first callers you addressed from Jamaica Plain addressed. I'm not piggybacking on him, but
sure.
He helped me a little bit. And, you know, for example, one example I get off the line. Raytheon Corporation is here. Its corporation, its headquarters is here. Its Sudbury plant is closed. Andover plant is closed. And the biggest missile development plant in the world exists between Tucson and the Mexican border. And all of its workers come across the border to work one day. Those kinds of issues have got to be addressed. And once those kinds of things are brought back, then the city will rise again. And the harbor, which has lost, will have jobs again.
Well,
I'll take your answer off the phone, sir. But
sure.
And maybe you weren't in intention to write that in the book, but I certainly, when you talk about cities, you don't talk about manufacturing jobs and the loss of wealth.
Ed Glazer, respond to Lawrence a bit. I mean, some of those manufacturing jobs, of course, not coming back.
Right. I have a whole chapter in the book about the rise and decline of the industrial city. And there's no question that it created enormous hardship in its decline. But in some sense, I think it's a mistake to think that those jobs ever will come back. And here's a way, at least, that I try to make it make sense. If you go back to the 18th century, cities thrived by having small firms, smart people, and connections to the outside world. This is what made the Boston of John Hancock and Sam Adams successful. Cities then created the Industrial Revolution, smart people in Birmingham, Manchester, and Detroit, working together, connecting with each other, stealing each other's ideas, created this massive wave of industrialization that enabled the production of cheap clothing and cheap cars with vast, vertically integrated factories. Now, unfortunately, those vast vertically integrated factories lost their connection to the urban fabric of life. And you didn't need to have Ford's River Rouge plant in Detroit. You could suburbanize it. And then later you could move it to right-to-work states. You could move low-cost production to, you know, any part of the world if you wanted to. Unfortunately, that isn't changing. Boston isn't about to be a low-cost producer of ordinary manufactured goods anytime soon. Right? We're in a global competition with China on these issues, and that's not going to change. We have to be smarter. We need to be cleverer. We're not going to succeed by bribing the heck out of Evergreen Solar to induce it to manufacture those solar panels. We're going to succeed by coming up with smarter, better solar panels, and that's being done right now in Boston. But we're not going to win along these manufactured goods. Now, that doesn't eliminate the problem that you're talking about, which is that those manufacturing industries were able to provide good jobs for people who had less education. And we haven't fixed that problem at all, right? Today in this country, the unemployment rate for high school dropouts is 15%. The unemployment rate for college graduates is less than 5%. Less than 4 in 10 high school dropouts in this country are employed among adults. This is a horrendous statistic and a really troubling fact. And I don't know any way to get to work on that other than the twin pillars of education and entrepreneurship. And we've already talked about the need to invest in education in this country, and that's the long-term solution. In the shorter term, we need to figure out ways to hypercharge our urban entrepreneurs and help them to create the jobs that will create more employment for wider swaths of America.
And don't we also need to find a way to turn back or to reform some of this public policy that you write is stacked against cities? And by that you know, you made reference to the home mortgage deduction, highways, schools. And my question, and we literally have sort of 20 seconds left in this segment, you know, how do you turn around the sort of political debate and really reform the political culture to have this conversation about how to make cities stronger? Because I'm not sure you're having it, but I'm not sure it's out there in the public in the public square, I guess.
Well, twice in the past 2 weeks, the president has pushed back on home ownership, both in the reform of Fannie and Freddie and in the budget. I think we can just hope for a larger understanding that cities are crucial to our economic future and they deserve a level playing field.
Well, Leg Glazer, thanks so much for spending time with us today, both in the studio and out in the streets of Boston. We're very grateful.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ed Glazer is a Harvard economist and author of the new book, Triumph of the City: How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. We'll be back after a short break with new details about the last days of the 70s and 80s rock group Boston and allegations about what led to the lead singer's suicide. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.